Chapter 8. O bells of my native village, I am going away. Goodbye. Apostrophe, he had a good voice. When the last note floated away I remounted, but there was a charm in the spot, something particular and individual, because while we were looking at it, before turning our horses' heads away the singer said, I wonder what is the name of this place, apostrophe and the other man remarked. Why, there is no village here, apostrophe and the first one insisted. No, I mean this spot, this very place. Apostrophe apostrophe the wounded trooper decided that it had no name probably. But he was wrong. It had a name. The hill, or the rock, or the wood, or the hole had a name. I heard of it by chance later. It was Lasteola. A cloud of tobacco smoke from Mill's pipe drove between my head and the head of Mr. Blunt, who, strange to say, yawned slightly. It seemed to me an obvious affectation on the part of that man of perfect manners, and, moreover, suffering from distressing insomnia. This is how we first met, and how we first parted, he said in a weary, indifferent tone. 'Tis quite possible that she did see her uncle on the way. It's perhaps on this occasion that she got her sister to come out of the wilderness. I have no doubt as he had a pass from the French government giving her the completest freedom of action. She must have got it in Paris before leaving. Mr. Blunt broke out into worldly, slightly cynical smiles. She can get anything she likes in Paris. She could get a whole army over the frontier if she liked. She could get herself admitted into the Foreign Office at 1 o'clock in the morning, if it so pleased her. Doors fly open before the heiress of Mr. Alliger. As he has inherited the old friends, the old connections. Of course, if she were a toothless old woman but, you see, she isn't. The ushers in all the ministries bow down to the ground therefore, and voices from the innermost sanctums take on an eager tone when they say, Fate sent her. Apostrophe apostrophe my mother knows something about it. As he has followed her career with the greatest attention. And Rita herself is not even surprised. She accomplishes most extraordinary things, as naturally as buying a pair of gloves. People in the shops are very polite, and people in the world are like people in the shops. What did she know of the world? As he had seen it only from the saddle. Oh, she will get your cargo released for you all right. How will she do it? Well, when it's done you follow me, Mills. When it's done she will hardly know herself. It's hardly possible that she shouldn't be aware, Mills pronounced calmly. No, she isn't an idiot, admitted Mr. Blunt, in the same matter-of-fact voice. But she confessed to myself only the other day that she suffered from a sense of unreality. I told her that at any rate as he had her own feelings surely. And she said to me, yes, there was one of them at least about which as he had no doubt, and you will never guess what it was. Don't try. I happen to know, because we are pretty good friends. At that moment we all changed our attitude slightly. Mill's staring eyes moved for a glance towards Blunt. I, who was occupying the divan, raised myself on the cushions a little and Mr. Blunt, with half a turn, put his elbow on the table. I asked her what it was. I don't see, went on Mr. Blunt, with a perfectly horrible gentleness, why I should have shown particular consideration to the heiress of Mr. Alliger. I don't mean to that particular mood of hers. It was the mood of weariness. And so she told me. It's fear. I will say it once again. Fear. He added after a pause, there can be not the slightest doubt of her courage. But she distinctly uttered the word fear. There was under the table the noise of Mills stretching his legs. A person of imagination, he began, a young, virgin intelligence, steeped for nearly 5 years in the talk of Alliger's studio, where every hard truth had been cracked, and every belief had been worried into shreds. They were like a lot of intellectual dogs, you know. Yes, of course, Blunt interrupted hastily, the intellectual personality altogether adrift, a soul without a home. But I, who am neither very fine nor very deep, I am convinced that the fear is material, because she confessed to it being that, insinuated Mills. No, because she didn't, contradicted Blunt, with an angry frown and in an extremely suave voice. In fact, she bit her tongue. And considering what good friends we are under fire together, and all that, I conclude that there is nothing there to boast of. Neither is my friendship, as a matter of fact. Mills' face was the very perfection of indifference. But I, who was looking at him, in my innocence, to discover what it all might mean, I had a notion that it was perhaps a shade too perfect. My leave is a farce, Captain Blunt burst out, with a most unexpected exasperation. As an officer of Don Carlos, I have no more standing than a bandit. I ought to have been interned in those filthy old barracks in Avignon a long time ago. Why am I not? Because Dona Rita exists and for no other reason on earth. Of course it's known that I am about. As he has only to whisper over the wires to the Minister of the Interior, put that bird in a cage for me, apostrophe, and the thing would be done without any more formalities than that. Sad world this, he commented in a changed tone. Nowadays a gentleman who lives by his sword is exposed to that sort of thing. It was then for the first time I heard Mr. Mills laugh. It was a deep, pleasant, kindly note, not very loud, and altogether free from that quality of derision that spoils so many laughs and gives away the secret hardness of hearts. But neither was it a very joyous laugh. But the truth of the matter is that I am on mission, continued Captain Blunt. Have been instructed to settle some things, to set other things going, and, by my instructions, Dona Rita is to be the intermediary for all those objects. And why? Because every bald head in this Republican government gets pink at the top whenever her dress rustles outside the door. They bow with immense deference when the door opens, but the bow conceals a smirk because of those Venetian days. That confounded Versoy shoved his nose into that business, he says accidentally. He saw them together on the Lido, and those writing fellows are horrible, he wrote what he calls a vignette, I suppose accidentally, to, under that very title. There was in it a prince, and a lady, and a big dog. He described how the prince on landing from the gondola, emptied his purse into the hands of a picturesque old beggar, while the lady, a little way off, stood gazing back at Venice with the dog romantically stretched at her feet. One of Versoy's beautiful prose vignettes in a great daily that has a literary column. But some other papers that didn't care a cent for literature rehashed the mere fact. And that's the sort of fact that impresses your political man, especially if the lady is, well, such as she is. He paused. His dark eyes flashed fatally, away from us, in the direction of the shy dummy. And then he went on with cultivated cynicism. So she rushes down here. Overdone, weary, rest for her nerves. Nonsense. I assure you he has no more nerves than I have. I don't know how he meant it, but at that moment, slim and elegant, he seemed a mere bundle of nerves himself, with the flitting expressions on his thin, well-bred face, with the restlessness of his meager brown hands amongst the objects on the table. With some pipe ash amongst a little spilt wine his forefinger traced a capital R, then he looked into an empty glass profoundly. I have a notion that I sat there staring and listening like a yokel at a play. Mills' pipe was lying quite a foot away in front of him, empty, cold. Perhaps he had no more tobacco. Mr. Blunt assumed his dandified air nervously. Of course her movements are commented on in the most exclusive drawing rooms, and also in other places, also exclusive, but where the gossip takes on another tone. There they are probably saying that she has got a coup de cœur for someone. Whereas I think she is utterly incapable of that sort of thing. That Venetian affair, the beginning of it, and the end of it, was nothing but a coup de tête, and all those activities in which I am involved, as you see, by order of headquarters. Ha, ha, ha. com are nothing but that. All this connection, all this intimacy into which I have dropped. Not to speak of my mother, who is delightful, but as irresponsible as one of those crazy princesses that shock their royal families. He seemed to bite his tongue, and I observed that Mill's eyes seemed to have grown whiter than I had ever seen them before. In that tranquil face it was a great play of feature. An intimacy, began Mr. Blunt, with an extremely refined grimness of tone, an intimacy with the heiress of Mr. Alliger on the part of... on my part, well, it isn't exactly... it's open... well, I leave it to you, what does it look like? Is there anybody looking on? Mills let fall, gently, through his kindly lips. Not actually, perhaps, at this moment. But I don't need to tell a man of the world, like you, that such things cannot remain unseen. And that they are, well, compromising, because of the mere fact of the fortune. Mills got on his feet, looked for his jacket, and after getting into it made himself heard, while he looked for his hat. Whereas the woman herself is, so to speak, priceless. Mr. Blunt muttered the word piously. By then we were all on our feet. The iron stove glowed no longer, and the lamp, surrounded by empty bottles and empty glasses, had grown dimmer. I know that I had a great shiver on getting away from the cushions of the divan. We will meet again in a few hours, said Mr. Blunt. Don't forget to come, he said, addressing me. Yes, do. Have no scruples. I am authorized to make invitations. He must have noticed my shyness, my surprise, my embarrassment. And indeed I didn't know what to say. I assure you there isn't anything incorrect in your coming, he insisted, with the greatest civility. Who will be introduced by two good friends, Mills and myself? Surely you are not afraid of a very charming woman. I was not afraid, but my head swam a little, and I only looked at him mutely. Lunch precisely at midday. Mills will bring you along. I am sorry you two are going. I shall throw myself on the bed for an hour or two, but I am sure I won't sleep. He accompanied us along the passage into the black and white hall, where the low gas flame glimmered forlornly. When he opened the front door, the cold blast of the Mistral rushing down the street of the consuls made me shiver to the very marrow of my bones. Mills and I exchanged but a few words as we walked down towards the center of the town. In the chill tempestuous dawn he strolled along musingly, disregarding the discomfort of the cold, the depressing influence of the hour, the desolation of the empty streets in which the dry dust rose in whirls in front of us, behind us, flew upon us from the side streets. The masks had gone home and our footsteps echoed on the flagstones with unequal sound, as of men without purpose, without hope. I suppose you will come, said Mills suddenly. I really don't know, I said. Don't you? Well, remember I am not trying to persuade you, but I am staying at the Hotel de Louvre and I shall leave there at 11:45 for that lunch. At 11:45, not a minute later. I suppose you can sleep? I laughed. Charming age, yours, said Mills, as we came out on the quays. Already dim figures of the workers moved in the biting dawn, and the masted forms of ships were coming out dimly, as far as the eye could reach down the old harbor. Well, Mills began again, you may oversleep yourself. This suggestion was made in a cheerful tone, just as we shook hands at the lower end of the Canebière. He looked very burly as he walked away from me. I went on towards my lodgings. My head was very full of confused images, but I was really too tired to think. Part 2. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.